instantism turn. The big wheel sound of power with speed enough to burn. Winning. Spinning. Braking. The big wheel by Marx with adjustable seat, handy saddlebag, and a quick stop racing brake. Braking. Winning. Spinning. It's the big wheel with saddlebag and racing brake. Big wheel by Marx. If we make it, it can take it.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, hey.
Hey, 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 hey.
Welcome to Geek Brunch Retrocast. My name is Chris Ivey, and I'm here with my co-host, Mike McCracken.
That's right, Mike McCracken. What's that from?
Ready to bust some skulls.
What's Mike McCracken?
He's featured in our Kirby segment.
Oh, shit.
Today.
Okay, yeah, that's right. There you go.
Yep. We'll be hearing about him today.
What episode are we on?
I just looked, I think, 18.
18.
18.
Couple things I want to mention. On August 28th, it's Jack Kirby's birthday. And you can go to the Hero Initiative and donate under Heroes for what is it called? Kirby for Heroes. And put that in and make a donation. They're trying to donate proceeds to help creators in times of financial and medical distress. And I guess Kirby's family is trying to start this initiative that like for his birthday. And it started by his 16-year-old granddaughter, which I think is the daughter of the guy who is putting out the book, the Kickstarter book, but I'm not 100% sure.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm going to definitely chime in on his birthday and make a donation. They have a video and stuff where I'll put in the show notes where you can check that out.
Yeah, that was. I watched that video. It's really cool. You know, his granddad talks about how she was born right after he passed away, but she's, you know, obviously come to know him through stories from family members and, you know, photographs and all the work that he left behind. And I just think it's really cool, you know, that she's the one kind of spearheading it. And, I think if Kirby were around, he'd be really proud of her.
Yeah, because she's not looking to help herself. She's trying to help other people.
Yeah, and I think it's a real good, in the spirit of his legacy, you know, and that's something she talks about in the video where she thinks that the Hero Initiative would be something that Kirby would be really supportive of and in favor of, a cause that he really would care about. And I definitely think that's true given... you know, like the last part of his career where he was really focused on, you know, kind of ushering in what we've seen develop since he passed away, like the creator-owned market and Image Comics and things like that. You know, he was kind of involved in the beginnings of those kind of things in the 80s. So yeah.
Yeah, unfortunately, not with much success, but he was...
No.
He was... breaking ground for those that did have success.
Yeah, you know, he worked at a time where he didn't have as many options. I think he was pretty disillusioned at the end with DC and Marvel, you know. And even though, I mean, he's passed, there's a lot of creators that worked, or, you know, contemporaries of his and stuff like that that retired. And, you know, they don't really, it's not like they had a pension plan or something like that, these, you know, that worked for hire. So, yeah, I think it ties into Kirby's legacy really well.
Yeah. So I wanted to mention that before we got started. I also want to do a couple of shout-outs for some Facebook groups.
Cool.
And they all fit into retro. There's the Valiant Comics fan group, which I enjoy following every week. Just a bunch of fans that are hunting down those priceless things that are hard to track, and people that just show their passion for the material. And then the Charlton Arrow, I find that fascinating. I never realized how many books Charlton put out. Like, every time I think of Charlton, I think of, you know, Blue Beetle, you know, Captain Atom, all Question, all the figures that DC brought over.
Right.
And I don't think about all the horror or the other genres that they had, like romance comics. But man, I just enjoy that site just looking at the covers. So that's one of my favorite places to look. And then the third one is Dickomania. I'll be honest with you. I never was a huge fan of Dicko, even though he was like Spider-Man and Doctor Strange. But I think as I grow older, I really want to explore that work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, what I know Ditko from is some of his DC stuff, like Hawk and Dove and the Creeper, because that's stuff that I was really into. But I never was like, oh man, his art's like awesome. Even though those images of Spider-Man in the early issues are like embedded in my brain, like, there's almost like 25 panels in Amazing Fantasy that I like know by heart. You know, I can just picture them.
Mm-hmm.
And the first few issues of Amazing Spider-Man, the same thing. Is like every time he introduced a character, I have visions of panels that he drew. But this site is dedicated to Dickomaniacs, and it is a fun site to visit. And then the other one that I just joined is the Wallace Wood site, which I know a lot of his work from his horror books and stuff, but never really jumped on, and I want to explore that too. So those are four sites that I'm visiting quite a bit. I'm even contributing to Ditko because I am finding a lot of Ditko work in the back of these supernatural thrillers and all kinds of stuff. Like, it'll have the main comic and then it'll have a reprint of Ditko and Stan Lee story. And I've been contributing quite a bit to the site, posting things as I run across them.
Nice. Yeah, I have to join some of those. And what you say about Ditko, I mean, it's kind of the same thing for me. I maybe even less familiar with this stuff outside of Amazing Spider-Man. You know, it's I also have read and reread Amazing Fantasy every once in a while. I just, if I haven't read it for a while, I go back and read it again. But maybe, you know, and that's, I appreciate him for almost entirely different reasons from Kirby, you know.
Yeah.
But
from what I understand, he's a recluse now.
Yeah,
he has a different vision of things, but that's cool. I mean,
yeah, he definitely a very different personality even back then. You know, when he was creating, I think he hadn't got quite as disillusioned, or whatever you want to call it, that he is now. But it seems like he's pretty much always kind of been a little bit different, just from like reading that Marvel the Untold story, you know.
Yeah,
there are passages that talked about, you know, how he got to a point where he basically was just showing up and dropping off finished issues, you know, that Stan Lee would like make some adjustments to, but he didn't even want to interact with Stan Lee. You know, I mean, eventually he up and quit completely, but prior to that, their working relationship for the longest time was without any real, like, contact between the two of them.
Yeah. But, it's all fascinating stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I find myself learning a lot just by going on these pages about stuff I just didn't know about. Even on the Valiant page, seeing things that I didn't even know existed. It's kind of cool.
Nice. Yeah, I mentioned last time, well, when we recorded last time, Kara was sick, and early part of that week, right after we recorded, I thought I was coming down with something, and then I thought I had fought it off, and then I woke up Wednesday morning and realized that I hadn't, so I took my turn for a couple days there.
Well, it knocked you on your ass, huh?
Yeah, luckily I had that had already taken that Friday off. I mean, it kind of sucked that, my, you know, day off was spent lying around on the couch, you know. But but it took me out like a couple days. But I didn't really miss any work because I kind of couldn't. It just was bad timing. I probably would have if I didn't know that I had Friday off, you know.
Yeah.
But so that happened. But everyone's recuperated here. But and the other update I had of things I've mentioned is that unfortunately we this week we said goodbye to my parents' cat.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, so he was 10 or 11, but you know, my mom's going to miss him quite a bit. He was definitely her, we used to call him my brother because he was basically her third child. So I just like my brother, but his name was Pele, which I gave him that name.
Soccer?
When they got him, yeah, because you know a lot of cats like to play with cat toys and stuff, but he was particularly, like when he was a kitten, particularly enamored with those balls you can buy that have the bells in them.
Yeah,
and he would just go nuts with those things.
I am not even a soccer fan, but I know that name. Do you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Because
yeah.
He even made it into the video game world. There was like Pele Soccer.
Yeah. Yeah, I me neither really. I just had that awareness, and it seemed it was I suggested it. My parents liked it as a name for him and stuff. But yeah, I mean, he was kind of, you know, he was a family pet, and I lived with them for a little while, when in between school and stuff like that, and so I lived there with him and everything. So. It was sad to say goodbye to him this week.
That is a sad thing. What was it recommended? The vet recommended to put him under? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was like last time I mentioned. I think it was almost a month ago. In the last month, they were just kind of trying to gauge. And it's always a tough thing to do. I mean,
yeah, quality of life.
Yeah, they're. They started giving him prednisone, and it seemed like his quality of life improved for a little while. So they, you know, they weren't, they were trying to kind of gauge that. And also with, you know, with my mother, it was really hard to say goodbye to him. So, you know, they were actually planning it, but I guess this recently is it really deteriorated again. And, you know, my dad was having a real hard time seeing him, feeling like he was starting to suffer. So, they were actually planning to take him Friday, this past Friday morning. They were both off from work. They were going to take him. But my dad actually found him down in the basement Wednesday when he got home from work. He'd passed away during the day.
That's sad.
Yeah. So, but I'm glad my dad was the one to find him. And my dad kind of handled everything with finding a burial place for him and
He set up
kind of like a cairn with stones and stuff like that. And so that kind of worked out well. Like my mom said, he was really, really good to her about the whole thing. And I think there's a little bit of like, especially for my dad, a little bit of like a feeling of peace knowing that he wasn't suffering anymore.
Yeah, as hard as it is, I had to put both my dogs down for cancer, and as hard as it is, like it breaks you down for a while, but you realize that there's a weight off your chest because seeing them the way you see them when they're sick is like not, it's not something to, you know, it's hard to deal with every day.
Yeah I mean, when I said my goodbyes to him, I kind of, the last time I saw him, I kind of knew it would probably be the last time I saw him, and he was doing better, but even him doing better, I mean, he looked so tired, it was hard for me to see him. But, you know, it's always a tough thing ultimately, though, you know, with dogs and cats and other pets and stuff, they have a shorter lifespan. But I mean, ultimately, I think you, once you get through this saying the goodbyes and stuff, you look back and you are grateful for that company you had, you know, and like, I'm grateful for the fact that I knew them, you know?
Yeah.
So
are there plans to get another animal or no?
You know, I didn't ask. I'm not sure.
Cause you know, they're known to keep your spirits up and prolong your life. At least that's what they say in studies.
Yeah, I can believe it.
Because they're like stress relievers.
Yeah, and good company. I mean, there's like a lady that lives on our street that she's a single older lady. I don't know if, you know, if she's a widow or divorcee or whatever. I'm not really sure what her case is, but she got a puppy last year. And her, you know, her puppy and Luna are friends because Luna's not threatened by her. But, you know, and it's just nice to, you know, that she has that company and the animal to take care of and stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. I haven't asked. I know that my dad's going to be retiring soon. My mom's going to be going down to part time, and they're looking at doing a lot of traveling and stuff. So,
yeah.
So I'm not sure. I'm sure it's already crossed my mom's mind, but
are they talking traveling by plane or by like vehicle?
Probably both. But yeah, I mean, they are definitely a lot more independent.
Yeah.
A lot easier to leave.
I know a lot of people that just take their animals with them on their, you know, their vehicles.
Yeah. Yeah. Dogs are a lot more amenable to car rides usually, though. So a lot of cats freak out.
Do cats really?
It depends. I mean, Pele hated going in the car. I mean, that was part of the reason they hated taking him to the vet, because he would just like stress shed the entire way there. He'd like, you know, but
Did he have to go into the container, or is that why?
I think that they did, yeah. I'm not sure, but I don't know. Our cat kind of likes the container. He goes in there and just chills, and he's not too bad, like, when we take him to the vet, so.
I've never seen a cat hit a vet in a leash. I don't know. Like a dog, you know, how they just, walk them in?
Yeah.
I usually see them in those little containers.
Yeah, you kind of have to. It cracks me up. It makes me think that he's like locked up in jail. He looks like he's in a jail cell. Looks funny to me, but so yeah. So that was my fulfilling my duty to bring down the podcast from the beginning.
And then lift it up.
Yeah. I try to, you know, just so the elation of comic books is all the more effective. You know, I try to bring us down so that the comic books can lift us up all the more.
You'll take us to some really dark places.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the next Geek Brunch retrocast, if I don't have anything going on in my personal life, I'll do some like Google News searches for death and dismemberment. That's messed up, is what you were trying to say.
Yeah, that's pretty messed up.
That would be.
Well, Keith has Keith's movie pick is like people dying in Kansas or something like that. It's a documentary of people that are older in life and passing away. And I'm like, why are you picking that movie for me and Daryl? Like, why do we want to watch that? It's Human Condition.
A Human Condition.
Yeah.
The Human Condition of playing Candy Crush Saga. Whatever the hell that is.
I gotta figure out how to block that, because I get one of those little sausages showing up, the striped candy sausage or whatever the hell it is. I'm like, I want to delete it.
Yeah, I woke up this morning, I got another request from him.
Oh, he did it last night. He read your question and said, okay, here's the...
I figured the question must have came up, because I'm like, I looked at like 12 p.m., Keith Knudsen invited you to play Candy Crush Saga.
Yeah, so it was a funny episode because he didn't show up until really late, like really, really late. So we did the first episode without him, and then he shows up at the end. Like, he's like, I said, we're almost done. And he said, well, dial me in. And he goes, well, this has been DC Noise.
So, almost as if he was there and just silent the entire time.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So now whenever I log into Facebook, I got up in the top corner, it says 4 invites from Keith Knutson.
You don't hit the X's?
They're just building up. I don't know what. Yeah, maybe I can X it out.
I did, on the far right, you could just, like, there's a little X, and when you mouse over it, and you can just click the X, and I'll take it away.
Yeah. I think it's funny, though. But, yeah. So, Candy Crush Saga. He's not the only one playing it, that looks, seems like.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. I get invites from like 4 people. I don't play. I don't have time for games, honestly.
I just don't play. I play games, but not Facebook games for whatever reason. I just don't. I don't. I'm on the computer too much. I don't play computer games much. I used to.
Yeah.
Back when I wasn't on the computer so much, and growing up, and even just like, you know, the last decade or when I was working different jobs, when I wasn't on the computer all the time, but I was on the computer too much to be sitting on it on the weekend.
I was watching a Toy Hunter. That show's been pretty interesting. I know it's probably really staged and stuff, but the thing I like about it is they have the toys that, like, they had the Buck Rogers toys that I used to have. I don't know what happened to those because I don't usually get rid of my stuff. But I used to have all the Buck Rogers toys and the vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize how much they were worth, man. They're worth a fortune just because of the rarity, I guess.
Yeah.
And then it had an interesting segment on toys where he went to Puerto Rico Con, you know? And he bought a lot of, like, unique stuff that he thought other vendors wouldn't have, and that, like, backfired on him, like, wicked.
Oh, nice.
Like, he didn't take any Transformers and Star Wars, and everybody's coming to the booth, do you have any Star Wars? Do you have any Transformers? And he went with the strategy, like, I don't want to take that stuff because everybody else will have it.
Yeah.
But what he ended up doing to save the day is he bought bulk masses of the Star Wars stuff. And at least brought people to his booth.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah, I say nice, not, you know, wishing him ill, but just sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how much. I think probably some of that show is staged and some of it's real, but ultimately what you get to see is what's interesting.
Yeah, that's what's cool. They went to C2E2 too, and they had that flag, you know, that G.I. Joe flag, that huge aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
They had bought it from some dude that had 2 of them, and he had one that he never opened.
Oh, wow.
And they were selling, they tried to sell that for, like, I think it was $7,000, or maybe it was $8,500. I can't remember. They bought it for $4,000, tried to sell it for $8,500, and I think they ended up selling it for $6,500. But wow. That thing is huge.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. They don't make toys like that anymore.
Yeah. I have a Millennium Falcon, the second gen. I had an original. I have no idea what happened to that because I have most of my Star Wars toys, including the original Death Star. You know, the Death Star itself is about, I don't know, it's about 3 feet tall, maybe 3 feet tall. And I had the original Millennium Falcon, and I can't find that. It's like somebody took it out of the shed or something where I had all my stuff.
Yeah, I was stupid. I sold most of my stuff at garage sales and stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah, Barb bought me the new one, and that one's still boxed in the basement. But, God, I want to open it. It looks damn awesome.
Well, I feel like if you ever lose your job, you could just start up a full-time eBay business.
I have been selling some stuff. I sold my brother's Wolverine 1-4. And I think it went for like what the market was asking for, like just based on everything else that was on eBay at the time. Mm-hmm. It went for like $64. And I was pretty happy with it because they originally looked, when I originally got them from my brother, they looked like really good condition, like between fine and very fine. Mm-hmm. But then as I opened it, I opened them up, it looked like the parakeet had chewed a little bit of the corner of the cover or something. Mm-hmm. We used to have a parakeet. and then there was like a little wavy thing in the middle. So what I did is I took really detailed pictures of those damages, you know?
Yeah.
I wanted to make them aware of that they're there. Because it's really hard to judge damages, even if you have a grading guide, you know, that kind of tells you. It's mm-hmm. still like so much of it's subjective. It's like really hard.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I sold those. I sold Spider-Man 1-4. I sold Machine Man's. He has the original Wolverine that you're reading, the patch. But
yeah.
What I think I'm going to do with that is I'm going to buy the ones I don't have from him and then sell the ones I already have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't blame you. Like I've been really enjoying those.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good to have. Yeah, I looked at the Wolverine listing that you had. I think you did a good job. Like you said, just it's important to, you know, I think you put something to the effect of, I'm not a professional grader.
Yeah.
And I always include something like that, you know, to say I'm just a collector and
yeah.
This is what I think, but look at the pictures. And yeah, it's important to, I mean, nowadays I've been on eBay forever, it feels like, but nowadays they let you add so many pictures for free that you might as well use them and take detailed pictures so people know what they're getting, you know?
Yeah.
And thankfully I've been, it's like a, I mean, one-to-one exchange with eBay as kind of a mediator, but I mean, thankfully, knock on wood, like I've been pretty good as far as like the feedback I've gotten and stuff, you know. But some people are way pickier than others, you know. Mm-hmm. I found, you know, you'll get some people that just they'll buy something and then they're just pretty relaxed about the whole thing, and then you have some people that are just like sending you messages like, "Did you mail it? Did you mail it? What's the tracking number? What's it?" You know? And they're real just hyper about it. So,
and then I sold my Harbinger Gold for I think it was like $30, $35, which was free to me. So that was good. And I still have one more. I have one for me too. It's mm-hmm. it just every time you go to a con and you either go to a panel and learn the keyword or you wear your Valiant shirt, they'll give mm-hmm. you a gold book.
Oh, nice.
So that's a key for any con goers. You can get a gold book, and there and you can get anywhere from like $10 to $30, just depending on. I mean, just watching them, it just depends on how lucky you are and timing, and yeah. people selecting them.
Yeah, you can. I mean, I think I've said this before on the show, but if you know comics well enough, not like you could necessarily, you know, make a living, but you could get some extra income and stuff, maybe just to buy more comics if you know.
Yeah, that's what's happening to me. Like right now, I'm I originally picked up the Amazing Spider-Mans with Man-Wolf, and now I'm bidding on the first and second appearance of Werewolf by Night and the first issue of Werewolf by Night, because the I think the original appearances were in Marvel Spotlight, kind of like Ghost Rider.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had formed his own book. But yeah, I'm getting into these monster books, so I find myself looking for them quite a bit. They're not cheap either. I mean, they're really not.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because of the rarity or the sheer demand of them, but the Marvel monster books are pretty expensive. I mean, relatively speaking.
Right. Yeah, I think it probably is a combination of, you know, they weren't the top sellers in the first place, and because of that time, you know, everything from the 70s is going up in price.
Yeah.
You know. But Yeah, you can find some good deals. I've sold some stuff that I've gotten, you know, through DCBS, so I paid like $1.80 for it, you know?
Yeah.
And then turn around and, like, some image number ones and stuff, turn around and sell them for 50 or 60 bucks, you know?
Yeah, those... I should probably sell my sagas and all the first prints of everything I have because they go for quite a bit.
Oh, man,
and then I could just buy the trade, you know? But, man, I'm just like I'm a hoarder. I'm not only like I not only love to read comics, but I have a collector mentality too.
And yeah.
Elitist. I don't know. It's like a weird disease.
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I'm kind of in between. I've like where some stuff I have no problem parting with. Other things, for whatever reason, are dear to me. I mean, I have all first prints of Saga. You know, from number one going forward, and I've been tempted at times like you, because you know the first trade is like $8 or something, and you know the issues that are in the first trade, you going on eBay for over $100, you know.
Yeah, and it's weird because you'd say, "Well, now's the time to sell it because the book's hot." You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like you can't get the story if you want to reread it, but
right.
It's a psychological thing. It's stupid. I wish I could just Barb would love if I would read it and then sell it, you know, turn it around. Mm-hmm. She'd be in paradise if I did that.
But it's like, but that's the thing, it's like some stuff I'm okay with doing that with, and then other stuff, you know, like I've thought about it, but I really love Saga, and I really kind of like, I like having at least a few things in my collection that are, you know, worth something, you know?
Yeah.
Like, not just having all stuff that's super cheap. I mean, I don't have much like that, you know?
Yeah. That's why I don't feel bad about buying the Bronze Age books, because they almost never go down, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
They either stay the same or they go up.
Good investment, you know?
Plus they're awesome. I think it's my favorite time. It's a good time to read comics.
Yeah, so you read some more stuff like from that era.
Yeah, I read I wanted to read more, but I got caught up in some of the current stuff. I was reading mm-hmm. Catwoman and some of the other DC books, and they were all good. And I wanted to read those Amazing Spider-Mans, but hopefully I'll get to them next week. But I had a choice. I could read more comics or walk Harley, and she was looking at me like, "Let's go, Dottie, let's go." So I chose to walk Harley. And
like, if I'm going to protect your comics,
yeah,
keeping a lookout, then you need to walk me.
That's right. So I could have went on the Werewolf by Night, but I decided to read supernatural thrillers. These were from 1973. The first one was by Gary Friedrich. Gary Friedrich is mostly known for his work on Ghost Rider. Like, he was a co-creator of Ghost Rider. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, he tried to sue Marvel several times unsuccessfully.
Oh,
and
right.
And I think he's got another lawsuit against them trying to get some kind of rights back to Ghost Rider. And they in turn sued him because he was publishing like short stories called Blaze. Like, I even bought one at one of the conventions. It wasn't like a comic. It had art pages in it, but it was more like a book. Like, he had written and then somebody drew a couple of pages of art. An illustrated short story. Mm-hmm. And I think Marvel went after him, and they won. So I don't know what's going on with all that. But this was by Gary Friedrich, and George Tuska did the arts with Jack Abel Inks, and Roy Thomas was the editor. And I am finding I had seen some George Tuska art with the Werewolf by Night on some of the covers and some of the stuff he did. I am finding I really love his art. Like, I'm starting to look at it and saying, I wonder if that's Tuska. So that's, it's like I'm almost gaining an eye for his style. So mm-hmm. He did this art And I really, when I picked up Supernatural Thrillers, I was like, do I really want to pick up the Headless Horseman rides again? Because that's what's number six. Because I was really going after the Living Mummy. But since it was in the same title, I decided to buy it. And I'm glad I bought it. It was a weird, very weird story. It's about this guy who's telling these kids. It opens up really strange. He's with this blonde woman. And his with his kids, and you don't know what his relationship is to these kids, except he's telling them the story of the Headless Horseman for some reason before they go to bed, you know, scaring the shit out of them. You know, Ichabod Crane, they never found his body or whatever, and then he has it turns out that he was the best friend of this blonde woman's husband, and the husband was killed going after a headless horseman, or what they thought he was kind of nuts, but he's a private investigator. The headless horseman, I mean, the cop was going after this one gangster and kept on talking about the headless horseman. And now this private investigator, his best friend, is trying to figure out what happened. And it opens up after he tells the stories to the kids, somebody throws a brick with a bomb through the window and blows up their whole house. And it looks like the gangster is trying to take out the woman and the private investigator and any links to them. And you find out it's that gang boss, the gangster that took out the husband in the first place. And that private investigator jumps into his car and says, I could cut these guys off. You know, the guys who threw the bomb through the window. And he chases them down and he keeps seeing like this headless ghost in the rearview mirror and freaking him out. And he does catch up to them, but the Headless Horseman takes out those three crooks that threw the bomb through the window. And the Headless Horseman turns out to be the gangster that sent them to be killed in the first place. So he originally finds the Headless Horseman suit and gets in a car accident. And they think that he's losing his mind, but he really knows that guy was a headless horseman, and he tells the cops, you know, I killed the headless horseman because he did run him off the road, and it's this criminal. He's actually a lawyer, and he's like a gangster behind the scenes. And he says, you'll find his body in this river, and the cop's laughing at him. He said, that guy's been dead for forever. So, yeah, that's a cool story. And then the letters page is really interesting. There's a couple things I wanted to mention in the letters page. Let me turn to it. Because this just goes to show that there have always been the same people you find on the interwebs today complaining about things. They were around back then. They just had a harder time of expressing their views. And it would take months before they could express their views. But that was actually in Supernatural number 8. So that was number 6, and then I didn't have 7, unfortunately. And then I had to jump to 8. And in 8, there's a letters page. And it says, today I picked up this month's Daredevil and Hulk mags and was shocked to see the cover price was 25 cents. I know it isn't entirely your fault, but if the price doesn't go back to 20 cents, I will be forced to quit buying some Marvel comics. It's nice. Getting too expensive. 4 comics for $1? Outrageous. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And then the next letter was from a female in Alaska. And she was asking if she could join some of these Marvel fan groups because she was a girl. And they're, sure, come along. We don't segregate anybody. And then
sad that she had to ask.
Yeah, the next one was a well thought out letter from a John Spoyer of Chianoga Falls, and he started talking about like how characters in the Marvel universe influence the viewpoints of kids. Like, if Spider-Man says this is bad, then kids will read that and say, oh yeah, that's right. Or if the Thing says this, you know, gangster activity is not good, then they'll read that and say that. And then he gets into the spiritual stuff, like the religious stuff. And he starts talking about, well, you have Son of Satan and you got all of this demon stuff, but there's no superheroes for us Christians. So that was another interesting email. And they had nothing to do with the magazine, because this said, we haven't gotten our letters in from the Living Mummy yet, so we're just giving you some random random emails.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. So do you want to go, or do you want me to talk about the Living Mummy?
You can go ahead.
Okay, the Living Mummy, issues 8 and issue 9. This is by, I guess the issue that I missed was, Steve Gerber. So that kind of sucks because I'm a Steve Gerber fan, but I guess he did one issue and then left. You're like, here you go. And Tony Isabella took over. What I know Tony Isabella from, I follow him on Facebook. He seems very bitter. He contributed to the Comic Buyer's Guide magazine when it was coming out. Like, he'd have an article in there. And he's kind of known for his Black Lightning. Very bitter about how DC treated him on his Black Lightning. Like, he's even frustrated that they had that Tobias Whale guy and they didn't pay him or whatever in the cartoon. Mm-hmm. But at this point, he's writing for Marvel. He's doing The Living Mummy with art by Val Mayomerick. And I've heard that name before, but now that I'm looking at it, he's got a pretty detailed, distinctive style. But The Living Mummy is about this guy, this mummy, that he was a good guy, actually. His name is Nakantu. He was a warrior king who freed his people because the Egyptians wanted to enslave them, you know, to build pyramids and stuff. And he freed his people, but the pharaoh captured him and buried him alive as a mummy. And now he came back as a living mummy. And when he first comes back, he's like, oh, destroying stuff because he doesn't know what's going on. But he's able to talk somewhat. I don't know how many people can understand him. I think they make it sound like you can read it, but he might be just mumbling like, oh, because his vocal cords are rotted away. But it was weird. This story opens up with him in space, and you're like, how does the mummy get in space? And I guess the thing that's great about Bronze Age comics is they'll tell you how he got in space. like if you missed the previous issue, they'll say, here's what happened.
Yeah.
So apparently he was in New York City and rampaging through the city, through the museum. I guess they took the what do they call those tombs that they bury mummies in? The caskets or whatever?
Like a sarcophagus?
Yeah, sarcophagus. Or... thank you. He was in a sarcophagus, came out of it, started destroying New York because he had awoken for so many years and was disoriented and just started, you know, destroying things. So the cops were shooting at him and bullets penetrate his skin, but they don't do anything because he's the living dead. You know, he's it's not going to do anything, but he does feel pain when a bullet hits him. And then all of a sudden he gets teleported and you're like, what the fuck? Why is he on this planet? He's like in Saturn or something. And it's these gods that teleported him there. And they're essentially the elemental gods, like the Egyptian elemental gods. They're called Hydron, he's the lord of water. Magnum, the master of the earth. Hellfire, the flame. And Zephyr is the wind. Zephyr looks hot. I mean, she's really cool and well drawn. But they're after a scarab, and they want the mummy to return the scarab because the scarab has imprisoned them from attacking Earth. Well, the mummy's a good person. This guy is like, I'm not going to help you take over the Earth, but they get control of him and then send him down there to find the scarab. And the scarab is being held by the living pharaoh. So you got the living mummy versus the living pharaoh. What's interesting about the living pharaoh is he appeared in X-Men comics around issue 52 or 54, and when Havoc was fighting him. So this appeared right after the X-Men issues, I guess, or, you know, shortly after. And the living pharaoh had the scarab, and he has a bunch of goons that are dressed like Egyptians with machine guns. And they send the mummy in there to get the scarab. He tries to get the scarab. He defeats all those dudes, defeats the pharaoh. And then some thief that you don't even see his face takes off with the scarab. So now the mummy is chasing the guy with the scarab. So he's still after the scarab. And they know that they're trying to get the mummy to kill, you know, the elementals, like, by commanding him, and he won't kill people. Like, there's a security guard, and he almost kills him, but he doesn't. He starts choking him, and he's like, I'm not going to hurt people. And so he's got a conscience, and he seems to be like a superhero. And if I remember correctly, I saw the living mummy in the Frankencastle stuff, if I remember right. With the creature, they have their own versions of the creature commandos.
Oh yeah.
And they're and he was in there.
Nice. Yeah, it's that storyline with Havoc and the Pharaoh, it's always seems strange to me. Like, it kind of came, it always seemed weird to me that combination of, like, you know, horror with the X-Men.
Yeah.
That storyline always seemed weird to me.
Yeah, it seems weird here, but you know what Marvel has going on at this time? I think even more so than DC, at least from what I can tell, is as you're reading along, their footnotes and stuff are more like, God, I want to go read that now. And then at the bottom of the page, they have these like little blurbs like, it's new, it's different. Check out Deathlok the Demolisher. You know, they'll have like Conan Goes Wild and Garden of Death in issue number 41. They're like advertisements at the end of every page. And it kind of gives you it says, you asked for it, we did it. Monsters of the Movies number one, now on sale. They'll tell you like advertisements just as a little blurb. And gets you kind of hooked to want to check those out.
Yeah, and they were real good about the editor's notes, too.
Oh, they're fantastic. Like, the Havoc stuff, it was like, wow, that's pretty cool that it's tying into the X-Men. They even mentioned Cyclops because the living pharaoh is fighting the living mummy. And he's like, well, this weapon, I was able to hold off. It hypnotized Cyclops. And the living mummy's like, ooh. I don't know what a Cyclops is. I don't know what he's talking about. And he's just like marching towards him to strangle him.
Yeah, I just it's sort of fascinated by the fact that that storyline had any kind of continuation outside of outside of the X-Men story. Because I mean, I've read that a couple times, but never realized that there was any sort of follow up or connection to it anywhere else.
Yeah.
So that's kind of neat.
And found out that Steve Gerber had written the one issue before, and some of the letters pages were like, God, I love Steve Gerber, but why is he doing a book about... Or they said they liked that the mummy could talk because they said then it would be similar like to his Man-Thing, you know, where the Man-Thing never says a word, but the stories are based around circumstances around the Man-Thing. And the people that are involved. And they said, you're going to just write another Man-Thing book with this mummy. And another interesting thing was one guy wrote in and said, God, the art. These were two issues that I talked about, 8 and 9. And it's they're both by the same creative team, Isabella and Mayerick. And one guy says, man, I really love Mayerick's art, but whoever's inking him really sucks. And they replied and they said, well, do you realize that Mayerick inked his own pages? Because he like was making suggestions for somebody else to ink them. And he's like, yeah, he's new to inking, but I'm sure you'll see the improvements in the next issue.
Like, insert foot and mouth.
Yeah. I love this guy. He's so great. Oh no, he sucks at inking.
Oh jeez.
That's like a Knutson foopah, like going up to the man, I really love this book, but man, the art's really terrible and he doesn't even know who he's talking to. Is he talking to the artist or is he
Hey, he grew up on the streets, he doesn't care.
He don't care.
But yeah, that's pretty cool. It's been interesting listening to you go through these this era, because I don't really have any experience with any of those books from Marvel at that time. I mean, the only 70s Marvel stuff is stuff that I've, you know, gone back and read some of the superhero stuff to see what came before what I read when I was a kid, you know?
Right.
So it's pretty fascinating. It's pretty neat to just, I don't know. I mean, I know why it's not that way, but there's a lot of things about the 70s that I wish were true today, you know?
Yeah.
And it's cool that they had success with stuff that wasn't, superheroes, you know?
It is cool because they had quite a few issues, at least, Werewolf by Night did. And, Tomb of Dracula, where that stuff couldn't even survive in today's market. Not because it's... I just don't think people try that much stuff, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's... You know, I'm not naive to think that it's possible, at least not right now, but I certainly would be pleased if there was, you know, more diversity in what Marvel and DC were offering. And, I mean, I understand from a business perspective... It just doesn't make sense, you know. They can't stay in business if they're putting out comics that nobody's buying, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But
like the two books in DC I'm really loving now is the Supernatural stuff, like Phantom Stranger. It's one of my favorite books, and man, that book's not going to make it very long, much longer, you know. Probably make it out of the Trinity War, and then
yeah,
it'll be done. And that Pandora one, I'm liking that Supernatural. I love the religious tie-ins to Phantom Stranger, like how he's Judas and he betrayed God, so now heaven has got him as the Phantom Stranger. Mm-hmm. And the Spectre is still a servant of God too, so you got the spirit of vengeance, and man, that's crazy. And then he visits hell and there's Ennegrin. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's oh, well, yeah, I think that the Trinity War is kind of keeping those titles afloat at the moment, so I kind of expect to see them go away.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's not... There have been things that they've tried, that they've put out there, so it's not like there's been none of it. But, yeah, in the 70s, I think, just in general, it was a different culture. I mean, that's part of the reason why I like... 70s movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to be a different culture, and like you know, you could be you had actors and actresses that weren't, you know, they could be stars and not be physically attractive, you know.
yeah
you know, actually, which not that that's the most flattering lead-in, but I noticed that Karen Black passed away this past week. A really famous actress from a lot of 70s movies and B-movies and stuff.
I've heard that name, but is there a movie in particular she's known for?
Well, she continued to do some work in recent years. She was actually in House of a Thousand Corpses.
Interesting. The older woman?
Yeah, she was...
Their mother?
I think she, yeah, she was Mother Firefly.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, but she's known for, like, Five Easy Pieces, like the Jack Nicholson movie.
Mm-hmm.
Nashville. Let's see what else she was in. I mean, she's been in tons and tons of movies. She continued to work in 80s, 90s, and even more recent years. But a lot of, you know, she came to fame in 70s. You know, was always a like a good B movie actress.
Yeah.
And she was in like Burnt Offerings, Family Plot.
Movies I think I saw in high school, but I don't remember.
Yeah.
Because, man, we went on a B-movie kick back in the day. Because we all, in high school, we all had, like, video cards, like, to get VHS tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And we just would go to the horror section and pick the cheesiest cover and go watch it.
Yeah, I miss those mom and pop VHS stores.
Yeah.
Those were cool to just go and walk around and you just see these crazy looking movies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They would basically try to sell them by the cover, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, August 8th, she passed away, age of 74. So, but yeah, 70. Oh, an Easy Rider. She was an Easy Rider.
Oh, that was a popular movie.
Yeah.
I never saw it, but I know it had Jack Nicholson. And who was the other actor in there?
What's this?
Peter Fonda. Peter Fonda. I get Redford and Fonda confused, like, all the time.
And Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, yeah.
I finally watched it a couple years ago. It was just one of those.
Was it good? Did you like it?
Yeah, I was entertained by it. You know, it's a little slow maybe by modern standards.
Yeah.
You know, but it's got some really entertaining characters in it. You know,
what is the premise of Easy Rider?
You know, it's kind of like it's a road movie about bikers. Uh-huh. And it's just kind of like following them as they, you know, it's like it came out in 69, so it's like that, it really kind of captures that era.
Mm-hmm.
Of you know, like the 60s counterculture and stuff. So it's just kind of like just, it doesn't have like a real strong plot besides, you know, that they're Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper kind of just traveling on their motorcycles. I think going to Mardi Gras or something like that from California, and all like the different things that they encounter on the way.
Right.
You know, and the misadventures. But Dennis Hopper is a really, really crazy character in it, as he tends to be. So yeah, I liked it. It's kind of it definitely captures that era.
Hmm.
You know, but for something completely different, I'm going to wrap up our Infinity Gauntlet. This time I read the last two issues, 5 and 6. And, you know, when we jump into issue 5, things are pretty bad. We ended last time with the cosmic beings about to attack Thanos. And we find out that Earth, because it's hurtling away from the sun, has entered into a new ice age. And we just kind of get that as background information between in a conversation between Doctor Strange and Adam Warlock. And but as we get like a little panel of showing that the Annihilus wave has appeared on Earth and is scavenging. Just as kind of like a little background information that I thought was kind of cool. But basically, it starts out, there's this huge battle between Thanos and the cosmic beings. And in the process, whole solar systems are being destroyed. And it's just wreaking havoc on the entire cosmos, or whatever you want to call it, to the point that the Celestials are actually throwing entire planets at Thanos, like populated planets. I liked the way that Jim Starlin describes the whole battle, and that you know, the cosmic heroes, cosmic beings, are using forces against Thanos that Thanos, with the Infinity Gauntlet, has control of, and he describes it as striving to drown an ocean, which I thought was a good metaphor for the whole situation. Mephisto, who's been hanging around, you know that he's up to no good. He finally makes his move and tries to take the gauntlet off of Thanos when he's distracted. And the only reason Thanos doesn't kill him is because Death intervenes. And at this point, it's pretty clear that Death, despite all Thanos' efforts, completely despises him. She actually is responsible for saving Adam Warlock and Silver Surfer, kind of holds them in this bubble to protect them from the destruction, which is basically destroyed Thanos' fortress, and he's just kind of floating on this piece of rock. It's not even the Cosmic Heroes can take out Thanos. He imprisons even Eternity at the end. And
how do you do that? He looks like the universe.
Yeah, I don't know. That's pretty impressive. But there's this really cool page where Taraxia, the woman that Thanos created, she speaks to his body, which is like slumped over in a throne and non-responsive. And Thanos, like you said, Eternity is everything, you know. And the way that they usually draw him is just kind of a vague outline that sort of blends in with the stars. Well, they do that, but with Thanos' head. And so when Thanos answers Taraxia, it's from above. He's kind of made himself one with the cosmos. And this is kind of the moment, though, where, you know, the gauntlet is still on his physical body, and Nebula, his granddaughter, who has been through this whole series just a shriveled husk, only kept alive, you know, by Thanos as a kind of cruel punishment, she summons the last of her will and pulls the gauntlet off of Thanos's body and puts it on her own hand, and instantly, you know, restores herself to her normal body. So Nebula now has the gauntlet, and it's changed hands, and she immediately banishes Thanos and Taraxia further out into outer space. And Thanos never thought to, when he created Taraxia, never thought to give her the ability to breathe in outer space with, you know, independent of his powers with the gauntlet. So she immediately dies. And Thanos, you know, he's able to sustain himself, but he's a portal opens and he's brought to Earth by Adam Warlock. So earlier, when the issue opened, Warlock and Doctor Strange, and they're talking, Warlock asks Doctor Strange to try to locate any heroes that he can, any of the Earth heroes that got dispersed by Thanos. So we find out that Doctor Strange is only able to locate five, which is Doctor Doom, Drax the Destroyer, Fire Lord, Hulk, and Thor. So the ones he got were the big guns. So Thanos is brought there. Immediately, Silver Surfer attacks him and wants to destroy him, but Thanos doesn't have the gauntlet anymore, and Warlock knows that they need him to take down Nebula. So Thanos and Warlock have a moment to themselves, and Warlock explains that when he was a part of the Soul Gem, and when Thanos first possessed the Soul Gem, that allowed Warlock access to Thanos' soul, so he's seen everything about Thanos, and he knows Thanos better than Thanos knows himself. And he says, you know, this is the third time you've achieved great power, and a third time you fail, and the only reason Nebula was able to pull that gauntlet off of your body is because your subconscious betrayed you deep inside. You don't think you're worthy of success. You know, Thanos kind of rages against that explanation, but you get the sense that he, you know, Adam Warlock has the right of it. So they kind of team up to take down Nebula. They throw the, you know, they kind of throw the heroes, the five heroes that Strange found at her as a distraction, like they did with Thanos and the heroes. And they don't accomplish much. She imprisons them all in like stone. But then issue five ends with Thanos, Doctor Strange, Silver Surfer, and Adam Warlock showing up. And Nebula only sees three of them, not four of them. And we don't know exactly why. She just says, Thanos, you brought your two friends with you, or something like that. And clearly there's three people with Thanos. So that's the pentultimate, as they say. And issue six wraps things up, at least for this storyline. Nebula, now that she has the gauntlet, one of the first things she does is undoes all of Thanos' destruction. So, I mean, in some ways, this could read as a convenient reset of all of the, deaths and destruction, which, you know, you knew was going to happen at some point. They're not going to leave, like, Spider-Man, Captain America, and Cyclops dead and stuff. But, I felt like it made sense in the context of the story. I thought it worked because, you know, it's just she hates Thanos, and in spite, you know, just out of spite, she undoes everything that he did. But she's confused. She's been in a torturous state for quite a while now, and is psychically scarred by that and inexperienced. You know, she's never had power on this scale. Thanos hadn't either, but had something approximating it before, at least, and had time to adjust to having the Infinity Gauntlet and stuff. So the cosmic beings, who she kind of forgot about, attack her and sort of keep her on her toes and distracted, while Adam Warlock, you know, puts into place the last parts of his plan. He takes himself and Silver Surfer into the Soul Gem, and they kind of do a mind meld of sorts. Basically, they see all of each other in a mental sense. Though I guess Silver Surfer is walking around naked all the time, anyways.
Could see his junk.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a gold penis or a silver penis.
They see all of each other.
And he's gold. Well, he looks bronze.
Yeah, so like gold and silver.
Yeah.
They just need like a bronze guy, and like they could be the Olympic medal team.
What are your thoughts on Warlock? Like, do you find him interesting? Like, you'd want to pursue reading about him, or is he some character that's just a plot device in this book and you don't really want to find out more about him?
You know, that's a really good question, because I was wondering, after finishing this, why. I mean, I remember liking this series and being excited about it as a kid, but I wondered why I didn't go ahead and pick up, you know, issue one of War. I think he's the most interesting that he's been throughout this series, but I'm kind of interested now in reading Infinity Watch and Infinity War and stuff, mostly because I never did,
Yeah.
But I, he's not definitely not a favorite character of mine. He's like I said, he gets a bit more interesting here than previously. In the first five issues, he's kind of, there's not really much to identify with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you kind of feel about him, or?
I never got into him, but
yeah.
I've been thinking about trying the power of the warlock in the Bronze Age, you know, and see it, dip my toe in. There's so many titles I want to at least try, and I think that's one of them. And I want to like look at Doctor Strange again.
Yeah.
Like to try some old Doctor Strange. I wish I just had more time and infinite amount of time to read.
Yeah.
That's my ideal of paradise. Like, be healthy in retirement and just be able to sit on the deck and read comics.
Yeah.
And go for walks and do all kinds of things. That's my idea. And then travel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even have to travel a lot. Just maybe twice a year, you know, have a good week vacation. And if I can do that, I've achieved greatness.
Yeah, we were talking yesterday. You know, my parents came down and we went out to eat and stuff. And we were talking afterwards, you know, just about the fact that they're getting close to retirement and stuff. And, you know, what people do when they retire and stuff. And how some people, you know, like Kara's dad, he's still not retired, even though he's well past retirement age, because he just really loves his job and doesn't want to give it up, you know, even though I think he is starting to think about it. But, and it's just funny because I've never been somebody, like even when I get older, you know, it's like I could retire right now and I could fully occupy myself for the next, you know, 50 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Like I have no problem. Like there's plenty of comics to read, and when I'm done reading the comics, I can play games and like.
Yeah, I think as long as you have enough money to like have the cable or dish to watch TV and your entertainment vices, like I could go to the movies once a month and buy popcorn, you know.
Right.
If I could do all that at a minimum, I'll be very happy, and then be healthy, so I'm not in bed all the time. I don't want to be in bed reading. I want to be on the deck.
Right.
So.
Yeah, as long as, you know, it's not like I'm into rock climbing, so I don't have to be, you know, in cheap physical state or anything.
Yeah, but like hiking's free. You could go hiking and then do all these kind of wilderness trails every week and entertain yourself, you know? I could go read at the top of the mountain.
Yeah.
I could take a Jack Kirby omnibus on the top of the mountain and just read.
Yeah, when you get to a nice big BARDA page, you can just let out a
scream at the top
yodel.
Of my lungs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
and I need Barb to be there with me. I really do. If I don't know, I didn't want to think about it, but if that happened, it's not even worth it.
Yeah. Now who's bringing down the podcast?
Yeah. What the hell happened? We were talking about the Silver Surfer's junk, and then how did we go here?
Yeah, we went pretty far in a couple minutes there. But don't take my job. That's my role on the podcast.
So they're in each other.
Yeah. So Warlock and Surfer have become one with each other. No, but they basically, Warlock wants you know, he as it turns out, he's planned a lot of this in advance, and he has number of reasons for wanting Silver Surfer to see his soul and to know everything about him, and you know, vice versa. And at the moment, you know, the reason that he states is that he wants Surfer to know his plan, his final plan to deal with this whole problem with the gauntlet, and you know, without having to explain it to him. And it's kind of good timing because Nebula does eventually overcome the cosmic beings, and so at that moment, from like Warlock basically becomes one with the Soul Gem, and as a result, he's able to disrupt and cause a fracture of sorts. Not a physical fracture, but just he's able to disrupt the other gems enough that the gauntlet falls from Nebula's hand. And, you know, everyone, Thanos has been cooperating, but obviously at this moment he makes a rush to get the gauntlet back, as does, you know, pretty much everyone is either fighting to get to the gauntlet or trying to stop them from getting to the gauntlet, you know, Thor and Hulk and the other heroes. And as this melee of sorts, this battle royal is happening, Warlock comes out of the Soul Gem and picks up the Infinity Gauntlet and puts it on. And you get this nice page of a portrait of the reaction shot of every single person that's there to him doing this. Thanos takes that moment to tell everyone that since he's lost the nuclear device that he has strapped on his person is going to detonate. So Thor smacks him with Mjolnir and sends him out into space, and we see an explosion in the distance. Star Fox takes Nebula with him back to Titan to be judged for her actions. And, you know, the Earth heroes are a bit uncomfortable with Warlock possessing the gauntlet, but he sends them back to Earth. So they're going to have to deal with it. And then our epilogue is pretty cool. We flash 2 months into the future, and Warlock is with Gamora and Pip, and they're on this planet, and they come across, they see Thanos in the distance, but it turns out to be a scarecrow wearing Thanos's, you know, customary battle armor that we usually see him in. And Thanos himself is a farmer on this sort of alien planet. He's dressed just simply in some like brown fabrics, no helmet on, you know, not much of anything besides just this simple garment and his purple skin. You know, Thanos and Warlock greet each other, and you know, it's just this exchange where Pip and Gamora are kind of expecting that they're here to take out Thanos once and for all, but Warlock now, with the power of a god, just kind of wants to check in on Thanos and kind of, as you know, one being has the power of a god to one that used to have it, commiserate. It's just kind of this moment where Warlock says something to the effect of, you know, why do you always say that in response to Thanos, even though this is the first time it seems that they've experienced it, Thanos, because he's, or rather Adam Warlock, because he's omniscient and omnipotent and et cetera, et cetera. He's already experienced this exact moment multiple times. Thanos just kind of says something simple like, takes a while to get used to, huh? And, you know, so Warlock and his companions leave, and the last moments are just Thanos' thoughts, and thought that it wrapped up kind of nicely. You know, Thanos just thinks about how Warlock was someone who never wanted the power he now has and has to figure out how to deal with it. And, you know, Thanos now, that he wanted all that power, and now he has no power. And neither of them really got what they want, but he feels like Thanos, in the long run, actually was better off by not getting what he wanted. So even though the story, as comics do, continues on into other, you know, Infinity War and such, and Thanos doesn't remain a farmer, and this isn't the end of the story. If you wanted this to be the end of the story, if you wanted to just read Infinity Gauntlet and kind of leave things where they're at, I thought it was a nice, like a really nice tie-up and a really nice, neat resolution for the story. So I was pleased with it.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And you've read all of that before. It was the Thanos quest number 2 that you hadn't read before, right?
Right, and
some of the Surfer issues you hadn't read?
I think I read all the Surfer issues in addition, even more so than ones that that just got kind of summarized at the beginning of Infinity Gauntlet that are now in Marvel Unlimited. But I didn't remember it very well. I didn't come back to me in the sense of there were certain moments that came back to me, but I couldn't quite remember how everything resolved. So, you know, I haven't really read much Marvel Cosmic after this, so I'm kind of intrigued to maybe check out how the story continues. But like I said, if I don't, this has a pretty nice resolution. I like the way that things turned out.
So you're going to continue, or are you going to move on to something different?
Well, I don't know if I'll continue right away.
Yeah.
At least on the talk about on the show and stuff. I mean, unless, you know, we get some people.
I know you hooked Daryl again, because Daryl's like, I guess he spent all kinds of money on the digitals to reread the Infinity Gauntlet.
Did he?
And Thanos, yeah. Because I guess they had a 99-cent sale on Thanos.
Yeah, it's good timing. I mean, they're definitely, right now, in the time that I've been doing this, it wasn't there when I started out, but in the time that I've been doing this now, when you go to Marvel's website, they have it's like Road to Infinity or something like that. You know, so they're tying it into the crossover that's starting.
Yeah.
But they have links. It plays out back, you know, prior to stuff that I've talked about, like the earlier storylines with the Avengers and stuff about Thanos prior to this, and then, you know, this stuff, and then stuff after it, Infinity Watch and War and all that stuff. So they're definitely like pumping it. So they have like a reading guide now. So it's certainly a good time to revisit this stuff. You know, it's coming back up again. Thanos is coming up again. But yeah, and this was originally a listener suggestion, a really good one. So, you know, if anyone has a strong opinion about, you know, whether you're sick of hearing about this or you want to hear more or whatever, you can. The squeaky wheel gets the grease. Let your voice be heard.
Yes.
Put some peer pressure on.
Let us know. We haven't had any emails like what you'd like, they'd like to see. Well, I guess we have some questions.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, definitely.
Let me scroll down here. It's from Donald Eugene Fight. He's digging a lot of the Bronze Age stuff that I'm exploring.
Cool.
And he says, you may have already been asked this question. Are you eventually going to go through Kirby's Demon? Yeah, I probably will. I don't know if you will. But I have the omnibus of the Demon. I have the omnibus of the Challengers of the Unknown. I've got the Superpowers Kirby. I got I got a lot of them. The Boy Commandos I have, I believe. Mm-hmm. Newsboy Legion one. So I just don't know what I'm gonna do next after we're done with the fourth world. And yeah, we're at fourth volume here.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I do like having the part of the show be something that we both read. So I definitely want to continue with that. And I do have Demon and the Commandy volumes, Homak, and what's it called? The Squad of Soldiers. That Andy Diggle later did a series based on, I think, or what the hell is it called? Well, regardless,
I have that Green Arrow cover too.
Yeah.
I don't know what that
is. So, yeah, I mean, I'm obviously not opposed to reading some more Kirby. Then, on the other hand, there's part of me that thinks, like, it'd be cool to. Oh, The Losers. That's what I was trying to think of.
Oh, yeah.
But also, like, maybe it might be interesting to highlight, you know, Steve Ditko or something like that, too. So, yeah, I'll have to think about it.
Yeah.
Maybe we can even do a poll or something with some choices.
Sure.
But we got several episodes yet before we get to that point.
And the next question he says is, did you read John Byrne's Blood of the Demon? He says, out of the other Demon series after Kirby, Blood was the closest in spirit. I did. I would say it was the closest in spirit, but the one I preferred was the Garth Ennis and the Garth Ennis Demon and Alan Grant Demon. That was awesome. I that's one that I'd like to revisit at some point. That was really cool. Did you read the John Byrne Blood of the Demon?
Mm-mm. No, I mean I'm aware of it. That's thought of as being good, but I really haven't read much Demon, you know, besides when he showed up other places sometimes. I read, you know, some of Demon Knights and stuff like that, but yeah, I haven't really read too much.
And interesting enough, I guess I never finished reading it. I mean, I have them. I know I have them all. But it looks like I stopped with 9 and didn't read, like, 10 through 16. So I ought to pick that up again. It was co-written by Will Pfeiffer and John Byrne with art by John Byrne. 2005. So it doesn't quite meet our 10-year requirement.
Yeah. No, at least not at the moment.
That is interesting that I haven't read them yet. I hope I have them.
Yeah.
I have so many unread comics, it's sad. So the next question is from Paul Price. Did you both Donald and Paul enjoy this podcast, and they pretty much give us feedback every episode, so I appreciate that.
Awesome.
Did you ever read the post-Crisis Blue Beetle series? There were a bunch of fun series after Crisis of Infinite Earths. Yes, I did. And I remember liking it. I don't remember, like, I don't remember saying, damn, these stories are, like, revolutionary, but I enjoyed the Blue Beetle. And the thing I liked most about the Blue Beetle series was the Paris Cullen art. He drew some awesome bug eyes because he draws eyes big anyway. But he had a very distinctive art style that I really enjoyed. And Paris Cullen also did some New Gods. So, yeah, I'd like to revisit some Paris Cullen. Did you read any of the post-Crisis stuff?
I've read a few issues more recently. You know, like I said, I didn't grow up reading any DC, so but because that's the era that matches the era of Marvel stuff that I read, or at least when I started reading, like that's the kind of stuff that was coming out. I've really enjoyed, that's one of the eras I've really enjoyed going back to and picking up. I've bought a lot of stuff from like Crisis, around Crisis and post-Crisis. That's one of my favorite eras of DC now as an adult. So I've read a few, but I like to read more. I like that Blue Beetle and, you know, that series. I like a lot of the stuff, like the new series that came out around that time.
Mm-hmm. Captain Atom came out.
Mm-hmm.
They launched a couple. The Question came out. Oh, God. The Question, by far, of all the Charlton characters that were launched after Crisis, was by far my favorite. I mean, mm-hmm. that series was very adult or mature and dark, and I kind of liked it at the time because Hub City was so damn corrupt. I mean, it was worse than Gotham. I mean, you think Gotham's bad, Hub City was just so corrupt politically and criminally that, man, it was like hell. It was like, build a wall around this place, don't let anybody out. But the Question by far was my favorite. This one by Len Wein and Paris Cullens, I remember liking the art a lot more, but man, I'd sure like to read it again. And then the Captain Atom one, what I remember out of there is the art too by Pat Broderick, which I really liked a lot. There's some good series that came out of the... And then Firestorm changed, I think, to an Elemental around that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, strangely, I did have a couple of Captain Adams issues as a kid. I just had a couple of random DCs. I had a couple of Batman issues, and for whatever reason, I ended up with a couple issues of Captain Atom. Nowadays, I have a couple also, but different ones. I have a couple because I, picked them up because there was a crossover with Flash, I think. But
these questions make me mad because I just want to go read this stuff again, and I know I can't. I mean, I know I can, but it's hard because I have so much other stuff to read. Like, right. I'm taking a little bit of a different approach than you. Like, you're a lot lately, you're revisiting stuff that you've already read, a good mm-hmm. portion of it that you've already read. My approach is try to read the stuff, I mean, outside of the Kirby stuff that I've already read stuff that I had never read or have no idea about.
Right.
And that it's kind of bad doing that because I'm growing my collection instead of focusing on the stuff that I have, but
yeah,
because I find out I'm exploring something and I really like it,
right?
And I'm no shit like a compulsive dude. Like, I found out I loved Man-Wolf, and then I'm like, okay, where's his first and second appearance? Oh, Amazing Spider-Man. Oh, those books are kind of expensive. Oh, fuck it, I need to get them. It's bad.
Yeah, in earlier episodes, I was reading a lot of stuff that was new to me. I think I'm kind of getting to where I want to do that again. But, I like doing both. I mean, and the stuff I'm revisiting is stuff that I haven't read since they came out when I was a kid. So it's almost like, I mean, I remember bits and pieces, but it's really, you know, I don't remember a lot.
I guess what I'm getting at is I want to go read Blue Beetle.
Yeah.
I want to go read The Question and Captain Atom right now.
Mm-hmm.
But, man.
Yeah, you think about, like, Captain Atom, Flash, and stuff, that brings you to Justice League International and
yeah,
keeps going.
So the Justice League International is kind of fresh in my head. I don't know if it's because I was more into it at the time, like, but I don't remember a lot about the other series, so I want to revisit them. The question I remember a lot about, like, I even remember where it became the question quarterly, and I still got it. It became expensive and only came out 4 times a year, but I wanted to keep following the storyline and the story threads, because that's when he fell in love with the mayor, and they had, mayor had the daughter, and then he tried to take care of them, and they left Hub City, and man, I have a fond memory of the question, but I want to go see some Paris Cullen art again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, his issue one is kind of iconic. Like, that's an iconic cover. It's got, like, the beetle and then him, like, jumping off out of the beetle on a rope. He always had that, the thing in the beetle that he could hang from, like, from the beetle. And he would always come down like that with his little light gun or whatever you want to call it. It's awesome. But it's different because Blue Beetle here is not the humorous Blue Beetle with Booster in Justice League International.
Mm-hmm.
He's not as wild and wah-ha-ha. This is more of a serious take on him.
Yeah, it's not as that element, isn't it? It's probably, it's not dark, I don't believe, but it's not as humorous.
Yeah.
As he was written in Justice League.
I'm just looking at the covers, and they're just awesome looking. I think Paris Cullens did a lot of the covers. He even has one here, like issue 12, which had the Titans in it at the time, like had the new Titans.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Cullen did the art style, and you can see he drew big eyes because he's got like Vic Stone with huge eyes, but it was a style that really worked for me, and it really worked for Blue Beetle. But, man, these covers are just bringing back so many memories. And even in issue, like, 5, the question appears. And it's an awesome-looking cover.
Well, is there any Paris Cullen's work that you haven't read that you've always wanted to? Or just to try to get you to spend more money on comics?
Yeah, thank you. I don't know. The two things that I remember him from are New Gods and this. Mm-hmm. And I remember in New Gods, his art style worked really well, too. I'm doing a search in my database to see if there's anything that I'm not mentioning that I want to look at. I think I have him as a friend on Facebook, but he doesn't post much.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that reminds me. Is Tony Isabella, does he still work in comics? Or?
I don't think so. I think he writes a lot of articles. Like, he blogs now.
Uh-huh.
He used to write magazine articles. He did the last work that I remember reading from him was when, do you remember Atlas Comics came back for a while?
Not really, but
Atlas Comics came back with Grim Ghost and a couple stuff, but they didn't last more than a year.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote one of those titles. I think it was Grim Ghost.
Oh, okay.
Blue Devil. Paris Cullens did some Blue Devil, too. Son of a Gun.
Yeah.
That's another series that would be freaking awesome to revisit. He did the Forever People. So, there's the Jack Kirby link.
Mm-hmm.
That miniseries. Some Hawk and Dove. I have most of his stuff. He did some House of Mystery stuff that I don't have. Hyperkind, I don't even know what that is. New Gods, of course. He did some Penthouse comics. Ooh. Secret Origins, I have that. Lot of stuff for Who's Who and Wonder Woman. I have most of his work. There's some of the, he did a, there's a magazine called Adventure. I don't even know what the hell that is. That's weird. I think that's a European reprint book. So That doesn't really count.
Cool.
Yeah, you must have left the industry, because I do have the bulk of his work. However, for some reason, I don't have his work in Green Lantern number 154 and 156. And I thought I had all those 60-cent issue Green Lanterns, but I guess I don't. So the Hyperkind is a Clive Barker book from Marvel. Do you remember Marvel published some Clive Barker books?
Oh, okay.
And he did
I
some.
Don't know if I realized that. I mean, I know.
Hellraiser from Clive Barker, and some adult-oriented comics in Penthouse. I don't have. Wow, this is cool. I can just go to my database and fall on this stuff.
That's interesting. I wonder if the Penthouse comics were just little, you know, like three-panel strips or...
No, they were actual issues. I have covers of them right here. It's Penthouse Comics number 6 he did. He needed 22. They are pretty damn sexy comics. The covers...
Oh, I thought that they were like within issues of the magazine.
No. These were actually issues.
That'd be funny if they were... They should do, like, that'd be funny if they're illustrations of letters that people wrote in, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they have those letter columns where it's like, you know, it's just, like, people making up shit. Like, I was walking down the street, and this car drove by, and there was 5 sexy women in it, and they just stopped the car and grabbed me. And
grabbed me and pulled me in the back seat.
And there's just this long description of, like, this is, like, erotic fiction, basically.
Yeah, some of these covers are freaking awesome. I'm going to have to investigate this Penthouse Comics. They actually have covers from, like, famous people. Like, this guy is Boris. Like, you could go, like, get a calendar from this dude because he does fantasy art. And he's got a cool cover here with dinosaurs in the background and two cave women fighting on the cover. And it says, one of the stories is called Cat Fight. And then it says, Pussy Panzer's Attacks is another one. And Hard Sex Detective Stories. Oh, the man.
Panzer's one sounds interesting.
Yeah.
Sexy Pilots.
Some cool, cool art. Tanks. Not to be sold under anyone... under 18.
I remember the comic shop that I went to growing up had you know, adult magazines behind the counter.
Yeah.
And so I'd be buying my comics, and I'd be like eyeing them out of the corner of my eye. Even though they were, you know, put in a rack so that you couldn't see much of the cover, I would just see you could just see the title of the magazine, but even that was enough to
excite me. Yeah,
I'm talking. This, there was no internet.
Yeah, that's right. I remember those days. You go to a bookstore to get comics, and they always had stuff in the back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one time I was there and a guy came in and actually asked for and bought one of them. It just, like, blew my mind. Like, if only I could do that.
Wow, so we started off with the question about Blue Beetle and ended up in Penthouse Comics.
Yeah. Thanks to Paris Collins.
Yeah. The tracking Paris Collins. And then we had one more question from Vicious Smith. I think he just said, what are the funkiest supervillains that we know about? And I think I'd have to answer that by doing research, because I don't have any that come to mind.
Hmm. Like, funky as in weird, or funky as in hip, or...
I don't know, just strange, I guess.
Yeah. We've certainly run into quite a few of them in the fourth world.
Oh yeah, Funky Flashman. He got named Funky in there.
It's in his name, yeah.
The volcano dude is pretty funny. A balloonist that became a supervillain and hated humanity.
Oh yeah.
Started making robots.
Mm-hmm.
He was kind of unique. The other one was that guy that had the anti-life equation in him. I forget what his name. Billy the Dangerous Billy. Billy Bates, Billion Dollar Bates.
Oh yeah,
that was an unusual guy.
Yeah, it's like Bill Gates' predecessor.
Yeah.
No, it just sounds like it.
Do you remember that guy Typeface, like from Spider-Man, that had like the letter A and like vowels all over him? That guy was
vaguely, yeah. I think, yeah, I came across him in one of the essentials.
Yeah.
Well, certainly the villain that Donnie brought to us last week, or last time.
Oh, Eraserhead, yeah.
Eraserhead. Yeah, the Golden Age and the Silver Age were definitely very good for that kind of thing.
Yeah, just... reading Superman in those days, you'd probably find a goofy one every issue, every other issue.
Mm-hmm. The Justice League fought some funny ones early on, too, I think.
Well, even Magna, or what's his name? Magna Khan or whatever? And LaRon, the robot? Like, that guy was like a strange villain. He was almost like a Galactus, but not. He was like a guy who sold shit. Like,
oh yeah.
He was pretty unusual.
Cosmic Broker.
Yeah. I can't think of any others offhand.
Yeah, which is weird. There's so many. But.
Yeah, just reading old Batman, Superman, you can find a lot. And then there's some bizarre ones that showed up in John Byrne's She-Hulk. But mm-hmm. I don't remember any of them. It was that one chick with a red sphere as a face. And she was one of the villains for She-Hulk. That would show up a lot. She looked like a regular woman. Like, she had the body of a regular woman, but her face was an orb. Mm-hmm. Ooh, Egg Foo, the Wonder Woman villain. He was a fucking egg. And he appeared like in one of those. I can't remember if it was the new the 52, the weekly series, or Countdown. I can't remember. But Egg Foo did come back.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I can't think of any others.
Here you go. Heavy.com, the 20 worst supervillains. Turner DeCentury, who rode a flying bicycle through San Francisco on a criminal quest to restore the lost glory of the city by the bay. Where was he from?
I have no idea.
Hypno Hustler.
Now we're getting into the Penthouse and Hustler comics again.
This Hypno Hustler is a guy with a pink guitar. Him and his band, the Mercy Killers, using mass hypnosis to take down crowds of people. This was a Spider-Man villain.
I used to think that hippie guy back in the 80s or 90s, Anger the Screamer or something like that, he didn't have like a special outfit, but he had like just a Levi vest and some Levi jeans. I remember him, but I don't remember much about him, but I always thought he was unusual. Luke Cage had some weird ones.
Now here's a connection to Donnie's Eraser villain. There's an Alpha Flight villain, Pink Pearl. She looks like a female blob. but her powers don't have anything to do with erasers. She's just, but she's wearing a big pink dress. And then Defenders, there's a Defenders villain called Ruby Thursday.
That was the one I was talking about.
Oh, okay.
She showed up in She-Hulk a couple times.
There you go. Yeah, she developed a high-tech organic computer and then cut off her own head and put the computers on her shoulder and replaced her head with the organic computer. So she's like got a hot body, but then she's got like a round sphere of the head. Actually, that John Byrne. Oh yeah, they have X-Fu listed. He made the list.
They have Big Sur, but I liked Big Sur. I mean, he was goofy. He had that Doofus P. Ratchet was his name, but that was towards the end before Crisis, like right before Crisis with the trial of the Flash when he was being accused of murder. And Big Sur was a man, he was almost in every issue.
Sugar Man.
You would know about that guy. That's an X-Men dude, isn't he?
I don't know. I don't remember him. A giant head with four arms and a pair of lederhosen who could shrink, grow, and smell fear. Yeah, actually, yeah. I think it does say, you can kind of see the part of the title when it's X-Men. Oh, yep, here you go, Typeface. Spider-Man villain was laid off from his job at a sign-making shop. Waged a campaign of revenge armed with nothing more than a bunch of giant letters. Yeah, he's got an R on his forehead, and he's holding a P in his hand, but he's holding it like a sword.
Yeah.
Terrible. Yeah. There's quite a lot of them. It's pretty awesome. Crazy Quilt. He's a DC villain.
Yeah, he showed up in the animated series. Fighting Robin in the was it Batman Brave and the Bold?
Yeah, those are some pretty good ones. Thanks, Heavy.com. All right, are there any more questions?
Nope, I think we're done. We could jump into the Fourth World Omnibus Volume 3.
Sounds good. Finishing up Volume 3.
What was your favorite of the bunch?
It was a tough call this time. It might have been Forever People.
That was my favorite. I freaking loved it.
Mr. Miracle was pretty close.
Yeah. Actually, but, this is the first time I think that Forever People ever beat out Mr. Miracle for me, but
I think
it was
you might
just
be right, huh?
So much I liked in this Forever People issue.
Yeah. Yeah, it's called The Scavengers.
And I freaking love the opening scene to The Scavengers. Like, you have this guy that's, like, in this futuristic vehicle, and this guy is a thief. And he just, like, attaches to this super-powered vehicle with his magnetic boots and robs them. And then there's this guy, this bald guy, who's kind of like, he's got these agents all over the world that steal technologies and steal odd stuff for him. And I found that whole concept of the scavengers, like, you could take this, the idea of it, and make an Image comic, and it would probably be successful. Like, it's just it's a cool ass concept.
Yeah, it's really great. And like the opening two pages, if you animated or filmed those, it'd be just a great, you know, intro to like a Bond movie or something.
Yeah.
Really good action piece. But, we get reports into this guy, who leads the scavengers that, they've one of his agents has discovered the Forever People and the follower that they're building to look like Dead Man for him to use as a body. So that's how it connects into the Forever People, and you know, they want he wants this follower, but he also recognizes Boston Brand. And we see that as he's saying that he wants them to go steal the follower.
Was the follower the same technology that Mr. Miracle had?
Like, yeah, I believe it's intended to be that same technology.
Because he had that robot that would mimic all his movements, just like the follower mimics whoever controls it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, and they've adapted this one. Different people have adapted this one to look like Dead Man. So when he possesses it, he'll look like himself. And we know that whoever killed Boston Brand has a hook hand, and we see that as this bald head of the scavengers, the director, lights his cigar, he does it with a hook hand.
And that cuts us to Seraphine, who goes to pick up Beautiful Dreamer at her modeling agency job. And I guess they all have to pay, like, rent at Miss Magruder's boarding house. So yeah. She's trying to help pay for their room. And she's modeling, and this guy here is photographing her, is loving every bit of it. And she needs to leave because they need to go. And he doesn't want her to leave. So what she does is she uses her powers to make her look like this ugly, ugly old hag.
Yeah.
And it freaks him out. He's like, what? I'm starting to freak out. I'm working too hard.
Yeah, she's like, don't you think you've been working too hard? And he's like, no. And so then she changes her form. Or, well, she makes him think he's seeing her look different. And that's enough to convince him.
Yeah.
Very quickly to take off. But, yeah, like, I mean, turn the page and it's like, bam. Beautiful Dreamer. She's got Seraphine as an admirer.
Yeah.
In her black strapless bathing suit. It's pretty impressive. And just, you know, because we've had the whole thing before with fashion and, you know, Mrs. Magruder trying to dress her. I like her, like, kind of futuristic sci-fi like mini dress that she changes into.
Yeah.
When they do leave, it's pretty cool looking.
Yeah, it is. And then Big Bear has got a job as a chauffeur.
Yeah, Big Bear is freaking hilarious.
Yeah, he shows up and says, "I gotta drop the vehicle off at the garage. I'll meet you later."
Yeah.
And Miss Magruder's like looking for Mark Moonrider, and he's like, "Where are you? You know, what are you doing down there?" And he's working with the follower, obviously, and he's got Dead Man with her.
I just thought that this would, you know, make a fantastic sitcom, like this Mrs. Magruder, and she's got these
hippies, futuristic space gods, hippies.
Yeah, living in her house. This is just, it would be, I would watch this show.
That would be awesome, like for Adult Swim or something, to go watch this at night.
Big Bear, and that's like, you know, he could get into misadventures with like people that he picked up in his taxi. And
yeah.
You get like, draw people in with like this, you know, the sexy with Beautiful Dreamer to get ratings. And you know, Mark Moonrider's always doing weird experiments in the basement. And, you know, Miss Magruder, she's a medium. You know, they have the seances. And yeah.
Could be a great sitcom. It could even work as live action. We'd be the only two watching it, but
yeah.
It'd be awesome.
Where's Vike? Oh, no. Okay. Viking does show up later.
He does. He just meet. They're all meeting at the house, and he just shows up. Doesn't say what he's doing.
Yeah.
But he's some mysterious crook, obviously from the scavengers, breaks into the house to get the dead man suit while Moonrider's up at the top with Dead Man talking to Miss Magruder. And the guy realizes, hey, I could get this guy to follow me out. He'll follow me because he's a follower. And he just follows him right out. Mother Box starts freaking out, you know, ping, 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 ping. And we shouldn't have left the follower down in the basement. And then everybody arrives.
Yeah. Yeah, I like how the thief is just, hey, this is pretty awesome. This is perfect. I can just walk out and this thing will follow me.
I don't have to carry it. I don't have to do anything.
But, so they figure out it's missing, and then we switch to the scavenger's lair, and they're testing the technology out, so they put up this strong man against him, and he goes to punch the follower, and so the follower imitates the punch and knocks him out. Knocks him cold flat on his back, and even though he had he was punching him with a steel glove on. Then the actual dead man shows up in spirit form and jumps into the follower, so he scares the shit out of them by suddenly coming alive on its own and starting to talk. But and this is where he sees that the director of the scavengers has a hook hand on his right hand, and realizes that he's found his murderer.
And but, Big Bear comes right through the front door.
Yeah.
It's still in his limo suit.
Yeah, that's true. And what's cool is that the scavengers, of course, because they steal rare items, they have all kinds of weird technology. And he blasts Dead Man with a freeze rifle, but then he lets out mechanapes, these mechanical robot apes apparently from a fully automated robot circus that they obtained. I wish these are awesome. I wish we got to see more of the robotic circus than just these apes. But he throws them at the Forever People, and Big Bear shatters them without even really intending to. He's like, wow, I broke those to the point that you couldn't put them back together. I need to learn to control myself. But one of my favorite parts is that, it gets to the point where the director's like, all right, this is not going well. I got to get the hell out of here. And so they set off the getaway alarm, and he goes to this underground bunker in this car that's on this, you know, track of sorts, like a car that goes through a love boat or something, a funhouse cart. And he's got this manager guy with him. This guy with, like, sunglasses on and stuff. And he's like, wait, don't I leave with you? He's like, you know the rules. You got to stay. The manager has to stay to destruct the depot when it's cleared. And then he just takes off. Good luck.
Yeah.
So, like, when you're done, report to Depot 4. You'll be getting your new duties there.
And Beautiful Dreamer puts a mirage there and freaks him out because it looks like he's going into a monster's mouth.
Yeah, he doesn't manage to get away after all.
And Seraphine frees Dead Man with one of his blue cartridges.
Mm-hmm.
He touches him, and Dead Man's back. And Dead Man's, like, whole now. Like, once that happened, like, Dead mm-hmm. Man's not in his spirit form anymore. He feels like, he's like, hey, I'm moving an organic machine that looks like myself. Like, he has a body.
Yeah, it kind of makes that possession of the follower permanent in a way. So I like the way that, you know, Dead Man is brought into this as a pre-existing character, and that it actually it's not just a simple, you know, show up as a guest star, but it actually furthers his story as well.
Yeah.
At the time, you know, I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, now he has a body.
Yeah, it makes, you know, and resolving him finding his murder and stuff, I thought that that was neat that that is actually furthering his story in the DC universe. You know, the manager who's still around makes an attempt to take them down unsuccessfully, and eventually they have the manager and the director, tied up and stuff. But it seems that the issue of Dead Man's murder isn't as cleared up as we thought. Then, where the director explains that there's many more scavenger depots and there's more men with hooks on their right hands. as implausible as that might be, turns out that it's not so simple as we thought. Dead Man vows to stay on the trail of the scavenger organization, and Seraphim gives Blue Cartridge to Dead Man, and they say their goodbyes.
What would really be interesting is to know if these Dead Man scavenger story exists somewhere else.
Yeah, I'd like to know that, because if it didn't, I mean, that would be a really cool storyline, just like a cool comic with Dead Man on the trail of the scavenger depots, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll have to do some research and see if it continues anywhere, and that'd be a cool comic, almost like in the present day Talon, you know, trekking down the Court of Owls.
Yeah.
But I like that, this is issue 10, there's one more issue, but our preview for next time is actually a preview of a new comic, speaking of the demon. We have, it ends with, a new Kirby blockbuster is on the way. He'll be coming for you soon. Look for him. Look for the demon. And there's a picture of the demon's face and arms clawing a wall or something. So it's kind of neat to see that.
Yep.
Cross-promotion there.
And then that leads us to New Gods number 10. And the continuation of the bugs. Forager, in the last issue, has escaped New Genesis after Mantis had taken over the colony again, and he used a boom tube to get to New York to try to find Orion, because the one bug priest, or you know, one of those bugs that was his mentor, told him he had to find Orion if he was to take down Mantis. So that's where we left off, and Mantis is awaking from his coffin, and you get a splash page. He's like, Mantis is ready, and they're getting ready to invade.
Yeah, and I think I like this issue. If I had to rank the three of them, this one probably be last for me.
For me, I think it would be second. I hate to say that, because Mr. Miracle's my favorite, but I love the concept of the bugs, and I love how they are invading New York, and Forager gets to New York and he's like stealing food just like he was on New Genesis. He's like, he's like stealing stuff from a bakery, and these bakers are like pissed as hell. They're throwing rollers at him and shit. And they're yelling, stop, please stop the little thief. And then everybody starts chasing him across the streets of New York, and the police are on him, and you even get helicopters, like police helicopters, to come after him.
Yeah, it's definitely a good issue. Like I said, it's when we rank these Kirby issues, it's kind of the least of the best, you know?
Yeah.
However you want to say it. The bug character doesn't grab me as much, and Mantis is funny to me, but, not my...
not your favorite.
Not a favorite, but yeah, but like you said, we do get... I do like these sequences, though, with Bug that you mentioned, where, you know, he forages, a.k.a. steals food, and got this gray sack that he's carrying with him, and he's, he's jumping around very Spider-Man-like, really, without webs. the way he's moving around, and you know, he's just trying to get away and get you know, get up to the top of a building so he can eat in peace. And but I like the cops that and the bystanders, and you know, the cops are declaring that they're going to catch up with them, and somebody off panel says, "Not without a fly swatter, you won't." And I like that the cops call him a weirdo. He's like, "Come back, you weirdo. We only want to talk to you."
Yeah.
But unfortunately for him, you know, cops have a helicopter, so being on top of the building doesn't do him too much good. And they manage to, you know, get a hold of him in a net.
But little do they know that that's exactly where he wants to be, because Orion and Light Ray are at the police quarters because they were arrested last issue.
Yep.
And the DA has them, and Lincoln's there, and they're questioning him. And they're explaining to the mayor and stuff what's going on, and that there's this war with Apocalypse, and they need to get out of here and go defend Earth. And he thinks it's still horseshit. I really like the scene where these two dudes are talking about the value of the dollar, and they're like in an alleyway, like they're in their business suits, and they're just sitting in the alleyway reading a newspaper and talking about that. And then all of a sudden, boom! And then Mantis comes through, and all these bugs come, and it's like, "Follow Mantis, follow Mantis." But it just made me laugh, because these guys are just having this conversation sitting in the alleyway. They're not like in a coffee shop or anything. They're just in these nice suits, sitting their ass on the street.
Yeah, I would have thought that they were homeless if not for the way that they're dressed and everything.
And the way they're talking.
Yeah. It's like, what are we going to... It's like, I keep worrying about the devaluation of the dollar. I just keep worrying. There doesn't seem much else to do.
And he's smoking a stogie too.
It also reminds me of, like, you know how, like, you know, shout out to Alan White and the Power Principle. You know how he's put people into issues of the comics, and that were like Kickstarter backers and stuff. It almost reminds me of like of that, where like these two random dudes, maybe like people that Kirby knew or something. He's like, "I'm just gonna draw them here."
There's my friends are so concerned about the dollar right now. I'm gonna put them in there.
Yeah.
And Light Ray and they're still explaining to the police when Mantis is invading, and Forager is arrested, and they treat him like a bug. Like, bugs have no status, I guess, on New Genesis, and they freak out when they see the bug, and the guy takes off his, you know, Forager takes off his hood, and he's like, "I'm just like you. I'm not a bug." And then they accept him, and he tells them about Mantis invading, and he's like, "Mantis, we gotta go get him."
Yeah, I like the way that the police, you know, so they've been sitting at Lincoln, one of the guys that has been helping Orion. They're just kind of occupying his, well, they've got him down at the police headquarters, and you know, since they showed up at his place, and they're not gonna let him leave. And I just like the way that they're. I guess he's like a private detective and stuff, so they keep calling him Seamus, and they really just like talk the police detectives and stuff like that. They're really just talking a lot of smack on him, and not showing him much respect. And he's just like, he's just taking it, and knowing that the only reason that that they're keeping Orion Light Ray there is because they want to be there. Cut they're letting them. But yeah, it's interesting to the whole bug thing with New Genesis is like, prior to this, you don't really get a sense that there's any kind of, you feel like maybe everybody is equal on New Genesis. So it's interesting that there's beings there that have some kind of a lesser status.
Yep. And they also did that like with the Inhumans. So I think he took some of the status from the the Marvel universe, because there were like different classes of people.
Yeah.
And they were showing like you have these people that are at the bottom and they're not treated like the royalty at the top, you know?
Right. Yeah, I kind of get a sense that some of the, he kind of continues some of his ideas there, you know, in humans. But yeah, so I don't know, do we, is that kind of still a mystery at this point? Like, about Forager, where he says, you know, yes, I'm talking to you by name, you Eternals, because I'm one of you, you know, that he's actually has a status equal to Orion and Light Ray.
Yeah, but I think in the first issue or last issue, he didn't even realize that he wasn't a bug. You know what I mean? It's almost like the Jungle Book, right? Where the boy was raised by wolves, and he thought he was a wolf until he realized, hey, I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's true. So, yeah, what he's presenting to them here is, that's right, it's kind of new information for him, too, or recently discovered information. But so that, yeah, so they team up as a result, and, you know, the police aren't about to let them go, but as we know, they're only there willingly, so they just disappear using Light Ray's powers, and, you know, Lincoln's just kind of smug, like, you know, I told you guys all along, and, you know, don't bother going after him, because the reason that they left is because they're going to be the ones to save us from Mantis and the problems that are on their way.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool how Mantis is attacking, and they're, like, just behind a wall, and then Orion just reaches out and, like, grabs his face.
Yeah, it's like for all their power, they use like a pretty basic trick where he just like runs by a wall that they're hiding behind.
Yeah.
It's pretty awesome. But yeah, we get a big splash page of Orion and Mantis battling out with you know, Forager in the foreground beating back some of Mantis's foot soldiers, which is pretty neat page.
Yeah. It's really,
yeah, I
mean, really cool action, and then Light Ray's like, we're not going to win this battle. We're just so outnumbered. We got to think of something else to do. So he goes to the Sonic Research and Development Facility, and they have this like huge gun, and I guess it can make harmonics that hurt the bug's ears, and that's what he's working with the scientists to utilize against this bug army.
Yeah, and I thought that was kind of cool. You know, it makes sense with the whole nature, the bug nature, you know, that their main advantage is their numbers. You know, one to one, they're not that powerful, but it's just, it's all about overwhelming. And we have, you know, some panels where we see in the background them just swarming all over buildings and stuff as like an army of bugs would, you know, of ants or something like that.
Yeah. I really, the more and more I see Mantis, though, his costume design is, like, awesome. Like, it's really cool. Like a vampire at the same time, but it's green.
Yeah. Yeah, I find him amusing. For whatever reason, he doesn't grab me the way that some of the other characters do. But I do like, it's funny, in some of the, at least, like, maybe more so when, you know, he's in the background or something like that. It's not a close-up on him. He actually kind of reminds me of Serpentor from G.I. Joe. Kind of, like, his costume kind of reminds me of that.
Yeah.
Light Ray's tactic is successful. And, you know, they create a boom tooth so that they can get out of there. And, you know, escape that gun, that sonic gun that Light Ray is using.
Mm-hmm. So that's a cool issue.
Yeah, it kind of just ends up with, you know, the three of them, Light Ray, Orion, and Forager. You know, that it's like we won this battle. You know, we've put off one more... thrust inspired by Darkseid, but you know, we know on this there's one more issue left of this as well, but that we don't really have any sort of preview here. Just as a quality thriller from the brain shop and pencil of Jack Kirby, but just kind of like sort of a peaceful ending, but a peaceful ending with a promise that you know, the full war hasn't been won.
Yeah, it's kind of sad that there's so much story left, and we know we only have one issue of. Like, I think the Forever People's detaching a little more cleanly. Like, yeah. they had their adventure, and now they're with Mrs. What's her name? I can't remember her name. I want to say McGillicuddy, but
that's Magruder. Not
Magruder.
Yeah, what we, you know, well, as we're moving, and as a preface to talking about Mr. Miracle number 10, as we're moving into Volume 4, you know, Volume 4 has Mr. Miracle number 10, and then has the final issues of Forever People and New Gods number, which is number 11 for both. Mr. Miracle continued up to issue 18, so we have issues 11 through 18 in order, and then, you know, which puts us up to... you know, up to early 1974. And then just to give an overview here, Kirby came back in 1984 and they did a reprint of all 11 issues of New Gods in a reprint series of like New Gods 1 through 5. And then in New Gods 6 in 1984, Kirby continued the story and used it to bridge the gap to The Hunger Gods, which was DC graphic novel number 4, which was published in 1985, which is about like 60 pages or so. So, you know, we get there, but that kind of... So, you know, it does kind of give evidence of the fact that whereas the Forever People sort of... So it did its own thing, kind of like a side story anyways, that the New Gods did have more story left, that eventually, though it took about a decade, Kirby did come back and finish that up. So we'll get to that in, you know, 4 or 5 episodes or so.
Yeah, the Hunger Gods will probably be one episode right there.
Yeah, I think it'll work out that way, that we can kind of cover that by itself.
Yeah,
but
if not, we can make it happen. Cause yeah. it is a denser, one looks like a other. More denser read.
Yeah. But for today,
yeah, we'll today
finish up with Mr. Miracle number 10.
And this one, to tell you the truth, I had to go back a little bit to remember, because. If you remember, we had a flashback issue, you know? Last issue
really?
Was the Hyman.
Yeah.
Hyman. And we had that issue where Scott Free was escaping just at the very, very end from Darkseid.
Right.
And then this issue kind of picks up back when, after the lump. In other words, they just escaped the lump, and now they're trying to get back to Earth. So... We had like a little vector there. It was an awesome vector, but I kind of wanted to see the ramifications of the escape, and I really wanted to see the relationship between Barda and him, like, you know, get a little closer.
Yeah.
So
you wanted to see more of the Hyman.
Yeah, I wanted more Hyman.
Yeah, it took me. I didn't go back, but it took me a couple pages to like recalculate.
Yeah, I had to revector because I was like, didn't they just escape Apocalypse? Now they're on Earth, but that was a past scene, and then I was like, now I'm a little confused. And I remembered the lump, but then I said, did I miss an issue between the lump? Because the lump one just ended, like they escaped the lump and they were outside of the lab where the lump was just laying there. Right. And now they're escaping.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just picks right up. There's no real...
Yeah, so it kind of made me think. Maybe did I miss an issue or did I forget something? That's why I went back. And since I had the volume out, I was like, yeah, I'll just go look and see what happened. And sure enough, but this has a cool visual. This guy's called the Head. Heed pants now. I always think of So I Married an Axe Murderer every time I see the Head. Did you see that?
Yeah, it was a while ago now, but
yeah, it's a weird comedy where he thinks his girlfriend's a serial killer and it turns out to be her sister. But Mike Myers plays himself. Well, I mean the character that's in the story that's dating who he thinks is an axe murderer, and then he plays the father as well. So he plays his own father, and then he has a very young brother who's got like this curly head, like, and he's got a huge head, and he's always yelling at him, "Heed pants now!"
Oh, I forgot all about that.
It's those scenes with this little kid stand out in my head because he just sits there and makes fun of his son the whole time. Like every time the son walks into the room, your head's got its own planetary system. And then the mother says, "Stop making fun of him." And he says, "Well, what is he going to go cry on his big pillow?" But that's what this guy reminded me of. A little bit.
Yeah, who was the female lead in that?
I can't remember. I can't, for the life of me. Yeah. But I think she was married to like a director or something. I can't remember. But it's a fun little comedy, you know? It's not like the greatest thing, but it's fun to watch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like a lesser known one that's decent.
Yeah, and I always remember the Alcatraz scene when they have the guy from Phil Hartman or whatever from Saturday Night Live. He's the tour guide in Alcatraz. They're taking a tour of Alcatraz. And that scene I always find hilarious. Every time I watch it, it's crazy.
Phil Hartman was awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That was a definite loss.
Yeah. I used to love his radio, you know, that show. I would watch very religiously, and
he was very good on Saturday Night Live.
Did he kill himself? Was that suicide? I can't remember.
His wife. It was a murder suicide. His wife killed him and then killed herself, I believe.
Oh.
There was like some drugs involved, and I think she was a fairly unstable person or something.
That's crazy how we go to like a lighthearted discussion and then we're talking about death.
Yep. That's how I do it.
That's how you roll. Bring it. There's got to be balance with the Lords of Order and the Lords of Chaos.
Yes. I'm like, you know, we're having a really good time, you guys, but cancer.
Yeah.
I just want to remind you that cancer exists.
Yeah, it exists. Don't forget about the realities of life.
Yeah, don't enjoy yourself too much because poverty.
Yeah. the value of the dollar is really bad.
Yeah, you know. Some people can't afford comics, so.
Yeah.
But well, yeah, I really liked the female Furies a lot. And
I love the opening scene because the opening scene where Bart is coming out of the boom tube, that is one of my favorite poses that he draws where like you can't even see the midsection, but she's just like jumping and you see her legs and her arms.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's awesome.
It's like bent half over and her arms are flying out behind her.
Yeah.
But yeah, the series are accompanying Mr. Miracle and Big Barda, and they just kind of escaped so quickly that they're not even really sure at first how, you know, where they are they confused where they're at, or they're just well, they know they're on Earth, but they, not.
They know they're on Earth, but it's like they didn't like calculate when. I guess they were so busy trying to escape, they didn't really like point their boom tube to a certain location. They showed up at a random location, and they're like, "Where are we? This is like a deserted place." And then they run into a turret, and they're like, "Holy crap! There's these people on this island or wherever they're at, and they're trying to kill us."
Yes, it turns out that they landed at the X latitude, which I like that name. And
longitude and latitude.
Yeah, the X latitude.
Yeah.
And they're attacked by all nation agents. Mr. Miracle and them take out the agents, but then they see a bunker nearby. So Scott jumps down and takes an elevator type platform down there, and that's when he runs into the head, the leader of the World Protective League, and the head shows them that they are constructing a orbital plague bomb. This big white bomb.
The head's awesome though, because he's like on this, he's like in a cube, and it's just a head, and he's got these like wheels that are driving him around the room.
Yep. Yeah.
And yeah, it's so cool because they have this plague bomb, right? And then it shows this disgruntled worker. We're not getting paid enough to store these plague germs aboard her.
Even at the World Protective League, they got disgruntled workers.
Yeah, he's like, we don't get paid enough for this shit.
Yeah. I'm surprised the other dude's not like, I'm too old for this. But, yeah, I love the next panel because I really love Mr. Miracle's comeback. You know, the head is, he's like, I'm not the only, wonderful thing around here, as you can see. And, after all, I'm only a pioneer brain transplant done before its time. And I like Scott's response is, whoever saved your brain should have considered the ideas it harbored. This is a pretty snappy comeback.
Yeah.
But, it's this classic kind of hero and villain where the villain, this happens like in a lot of like Bond movies and stuff where Bond gets taken around and shown the operation. And they're kind of treat each other cordially at first, but then the villain makes his move and traps the hero, you know?
Yeah.
And so the head blasts Mr. Miracle with his brain waves. And then we flip over to elsewhere in the plant where Barda and the Furies are trapped. But they're only trapped because they're knocked out. And as soon as they wake up, you know, they're like, we don't know who these people are, but they don't know who we are, too, or what we can do.
Yeah, it's so, like they took their weapons, their physical weapons, but they didn't know that Mad Harriet has these spikes in her gauntlet that she can release and cut glass with.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Stampa doesn't need weapons.
Yeah.
Her weapons are
just
her
use her feet.
So she smashes the glass that Harriet smashed. And I love that this glass looks like it's like 6 inches thick.
Yeah.
And it basically lands on top of the guard that was standing posted in front of it.
Yeah.
And I love Bernadette. She's like, she wishes that she had her blade because she would have killed the guy completely. It's like, damn.
And then
if only I had my weapon.
Yeah. Barda frees this guy who you said I was, Mike McCracken.
Yeah.
He was in prison there. Barda frees him, but she's not very like cordial with him. She's like yanking him by the neck around there. part that makes me laugh is Harriet's, Matt Harriet. He's like, hee hee, turn on to Matt Harriet, dear boy, if you're really seeking true beauty.
Yeah.
And then Estampa's like, quiet, you tattooed weirdo. If you have any true beauty, it's all on the inside.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, well, I think part of the only reason she lets him out is because McCracken's a big flirt, you know? He's like a 50s muscle hero or something. He's just like, he's Mike McCracken of the All Nations Agency. And he, like, you know, is putting his hand under Bart's chin, and she's like, you nervy, smooth-talking dum-dum. And so she rips the cage open, but it's mostly just so she can get her hands on him.
I know.
And he talks her down, but we're not real sure if she would have let him go or not. But at that moment, the agents show up and start shooting at them, so they kind of just have to get on the move, and he comes along with them. And, helps them fight and escape. So,
and then the head is putting Mr. Miracle in a trap, because every issue he's got to be in a trap.
Yeah.
they're actually putting him in this thing, gassing him so they can launch him. Oh no, that happens later. They're gassing him right now.
Yeah. But yeah, getting him ready though. But yeah, I like how, and that gimmick actually is one that I enjoy, that he gets put in a trap every issue. Like, if that didn't happen, I'd be disappointed. But yeah, like, they open the seal on the container that they put on him, and all that falls out are a bunch of, like, chains and locks that they had used to bind him up.
Yeah.
And, the dumb guards, they peer up inside, like, where the hell is he? And that's when he, comes flying out and kicks them both in the gut and then turns to Master Brain. But yeah, I love that, because you have this floating head, he's not, I guess when he's not on his little wheel cart, he can fly around in his cube. And I love that Mr. Miracle grabs him and uses him, puts him between him and the agents with the guns, so they're afraid to shoot because they don't want to hit their master.
But he blasts them as soon as he grabs them.
Yeah, that tactic backfires. Master Brain is actually able to put out a shockwave, and that knocks Mr. Miracle out. But fortunately, it's just in time for the Furies to show up as. From off panel, one of Lashina's whips, wraps around the faces of the soldiers. And, Mr. Miracle is chasing after Big Brain, and he chases him in the direction of the orbital plague bomb. So, Scott ends up trapped in the bomb as it's about to lift off.
But he uses his magnetic component to, like, take the head with him.
Yeah. There's this hilarious panel where the bomb's blasting off, and Master Head in his cube is attached to the outside of it. Ah, it's taking me with it. Oh.
Help.
It's just this disembodied head.
I could picture Michelle's voice.
Help!
Yeah. Help!
Yeah, so that takes off, but not two panels later, Mr. Miracle gets Bart's attention from the control room, and it turns out he didn't actually go up in the bomb after all, because he created a big slit in the rocket and slipped out of it, and then that same slit is going to... Leiden when it reaches space and cause the bomb to explode in outer space safely.
With the head.
With the head attached to it. He uses hidden anti-grav unit to clamp the head to the rocket.
So they conquered that guy, and then all of a sudden a scientist is like...
I love this too.
He just like shows up like, I need to steal this mega rod!
Yeah, he's just like a He's just a regular old nerdy scientist in like an anti-radiation suit, and he just swipes Barda's mega rod and makes a run for it. I'll give him points
For trying. For
yeah, he's a pretty nervy dude, but yeah, Barda just picks up like a huge pile of machinery that she rips off of the wall, throws it over his head so that it blocks his exit, and he's just like. His reaction to, you know, to being stopped is just like, man, so like, I wanted to, here's your rod back. I really wanted to examine it.
Yeah. And then Mr. Miracle lets him go and he's like, yes, sir. Thanks for the break.
Yeah. It's like, you should be so, you know, basically say you should be so focused on the fact that you didn't get away with the mega rod. You should be glad that Bart is not going to kill you for doing it. So get the hell out of here before she changes her mind, basically. So that's you know, the mega rat is their escape out of there, we finally get to see Oberon again.
Yeah, it's weird they destroyed that whole facility though, and you see them escaping with the mega rod, but then you see a plane leaving and it says all the personnel of X Latitude are mid flight. And they're like, the complex gone in one big blast. And then some guy's in the plane saying, I'm going straight after this. I'm not going to waste my second chance.
Yeah. The one guy at least has learned his lesson.
Yeah.
But yeah, Oberon, you know, he's at their house and he's just sweeping the floor. And he's thinking to himself, man, just another lonely day without Scott and Barda. It's like, you know, don't be a fool and think that they're going to be back. They're off. You know, on Apocalypse, and but then the doorbell rings, and he's like, "Well, I know it's not Scott and Barda, because if they came back, they'd be coming back in lights and whistles and sounds." And but he's like, "But whoever it is, he's like, I'm lonely enough that I'm gonna get down there and get that door." And it turns out to be Ted Brown, the son of Thaddeus Brown, the original Mr. Miracle, which you get a little. In case you forgot, we get a little note to remind us that's who Thaddeus Brown is. And Oberon is he's a sight for sore eyes. It reminds him of his old dad you know, Oberon's first employer. And Ted is excited to be there in the old house and feel the presence of his father around him. And they sit down to reminisce, and we find out that, you know, Ted Brown's a PR guy. But he just hasn't had good luck. He hasn't found any good talent to manage. And he wishes that, you know, he had some good quality talent like his old father. And Oberon says, well, I do know two people that would be good for you, but unfortunately they're not here right now. And all of a sudden we hear, boom, and Ted Brown drops his pipe in surprise. And so Oberon knows what it is. He starts freaking out, and it's them, they've come back. And they're running upstairs because that's where the sound's coming from. And it's this nice panel where we actually see the open door and Ted Brown and Oberon standing there on open door, and there's just these huge shadows on the wall. Which is a really kind of effective way to stage it. And then we see Mr. Miracle taking off his helmet, and, you know, Barda and the Furies. And they're happy to see Oberon out. Oberon's overjoyed to see them. And Ted Brown is like, that's what I call a cast. So, and Oberon holding hands with both Barda and Scott, and he introduces them to Ted and said, here's just what you were asking for, Eureka, we're in business.
Yeah, so I got to wrap up quick here because work is calling me on the other line.
Okay.
They're like, Mike, we need you. So you want to give our information real quick? Yep. I hate to do this, but
no, obviously.
Yeah.
So this has been Geek Brunch Retrocast. Thanks for listening once again. You can find us on Forums for Geeks. Twitter is Mike Myers Brunch, and I am MythMaking ETC. You can email us, Mike at Comic Book Noise, and I'm at comicbooknoise.com, and I am MythMakingETC@gmail.com. You can visit us on Forum for Geeks. You know, let us know what you thought of the episode, any old comics you've been reading, and anything you'd like to hear about on the show. And we'll try to cover it if we can. So I think that's about it.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening, and thanks. Sorry I had to leave real quickly, but when you were talking about that last scene with Oberon, work called.
Yeah. No problem, man. Totally understandable, and that was that was a great issue in my opinion. I loved all that craziness.
Yeah, it's awesome. So. All this stuff is good. Like, even when you say our favorites, they're all up there.
Yeah, it's like ranking three issues that I really liked all of them, but I just really got into the head and all these funny characters in this issue.
Yeah.
So, I love the Fury, so.
All right, well, thanks for listening, and I got to go and have a good week, Chris.
All right, you too.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
The Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour. Oscar-winning rabbit, Bugs Bunny.
And also starring my fast-feathered friend, the Roadrunner.
Roadrunner.
Meep, meep.
The child is after you. Roadrunner.
Meep, meep.
If he catches you, you're through. Roadrunner.
Meep, meep.
The child is after you. Roadrunner. If he catches you, you're through. The child is really a crazy clown.
Meep, meep.
When will
he learn that he never gets bogged down?
Beep, beep.
Poor little roadrunner never bothers anyone.
Beep, beep.
Roadrunner's idea is having fun.
Beep, beep. The Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour.